Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Brandon Allgood, the co-vice chair of the Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for this evening. We would also like to welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.com. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Sandra Faber. Sandra Faber is a university professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a staff member of the UCO Lick Observatory. She's an observational astronomer with a primary research interest in cosmology and galaxy formation. Some of her major discoveries include the first structural scaling law, known as the Faber-Jackson relationship, large-scale flow predictions in the expansion of the universe caused by superstructures of galaxies, ubiquitous black holes at the centers of galaxies, and the role of dark matter in galaxy formation. She was one of three astronomers who diagnosed the optical flaw in the Hubble Space Telescope, and she played a major role in its repair. She established the scientific case for the Keck telescopes, which inspired the subsequent wave of large telescope astronomy throughout the world. Faber received her bachelor's degree in physics at Swarthmore College and her PhD in astronomy at Harvard. She's a member of the U.S. National Academy of Science, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. She serves on many boards for several organizations, including the Carnegie Institution in Washington, annual reviews, and the Harvard Board of Overseers. She received the Heinemann Prize from the American Astronomical Society, the Antoinette de Vaucouleurs Medal of the University of Texas, the Centennial Medal of Graduate School of Arts and Sciences of Harvard University, and five honorary degrees. In 2009, she was the 2009 awardee of the Bauer Award and Prize for Achievement in Science from the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. And on top of that, she's also the current chair of the Astronomy and Astrophysics Department at UC Santa Cruz. And on top of that as well, she lectures widely about astronomy and astrophysics. So please join me in giving a welcome to Sandra Faber.
Thank you very much, and let me thank Brandon for that introduction and note that he is a PhD in physics from UC Santa Cruz, and we've known each other for many years. Thank you, Brandon. So this talk is a bit of an experiment for me. I've always wanted to give this talk, and what a treat it is to give it at the Commonwealth Club, because I listen to the Commonwealth Club talks all the time on the radio, as I'm sure you do too. This talk is new for me because it's only part astronomy, and the other half, the end of it, third or so, is an attempt to make astronomy really relevant, especially at this time in cosmic history, in Earth history too. I'm motivated by that famous quote. I think it's attributed to Herbert Hoover. It comes from my parents. I didn't listen to Herbert Hoover. And the famous quote was, a chicken in every pot, a car in every garage. And that, I think, has been the standard of judging all activities and all knowledge in the United States since then. And believe me, what's going on in the Congress right now really emphasizes that kind of, you know, practical. It's not worth it if it doesn't yield some dollars and practical import. So I'm going to try to argue a little bit at the end that astronomy has gotten to the point where you really have to start paying attention to what it's teaching us. And I beg your indulgence. I'm not an expert demographer. I'm not an expert in energy or those things. I've done a lot of reading to give this talk. I may get some pushback in the audience on one point here or there, and I expect that. So I hope we'll have a good discussion. Cosmic wisdom. An astronomer looks at human history. Well, my view of human history is broad and encompassing. My view of human history is that it starts at the Big Bang. And so I'm going to tell you about the last 14 billion years, most of which was our history in cosmic terms. That's the first part of my talk. So let's get started. A lot of what we talk about here is going to deal with galaxies. Galaxies are cities of stars, billions, 100 billion or so stars in a galaxy. We live in one, the Milky Way. And one of the most common kinds of local galaxies are these flattened, rotating pinwheels of stars. They display spiral structure. And we know they're flattened because we have put together the evidence. We see that we see different ones at different orientations. We think these objects are all basically the same, seen from different vantage points. And furthermore, we think that we live in a galaxy that looks like that. Let me defend that proposition. Here is a lovely time exposure taken at a star party. A lot of my favorite pictures are taken by amateurs. So in the foreground here are the amateur telescopes, and this is the Milky Way. And this is the center of the Milky Way. This is taken from the north. I think this is somewhere in California, actually. There's a little bit of snow that you can see here. By the way, this is a really nice organic pointer that I'm using here. Turns out the normal laser doesn't work on the TV screen. So we had to improvise. Okay, so you can see a lot of light here. That's a sea of stars. You can see a lot of dark. And that's because there are dust clouds in between the stars, little tiny dust grains, even smaller than cigarette smoke, mixed up with the gas that still remains between the stars. And pay attention to the dust. I'm going to come back to the dust later. It turns out to be very important for us. Now, just to illustrate that what we're looking at here is stars, here's a blow-up, and now you can see that this picture is getting very grainy. It's breaking up into individual stars. So you can take a whole series of pictures like that, put them together in a montage across the whole sky, and now we can compare this picture, which is the Milky Way, with a piece of a picture from an external galaxy, and you can see the similarities. And just to sort of bring this closer to home, if we could put this on this picture, this is roughly where we are, and the distance between here and here is about 20,000 light years. We're in the suburbs. We're not really in the boonies. We're not in the rural situation. We're not downtown either. We're sort of in the suburbs of our Milky Way. Okay, now, before we do more, I'm going to give you a really quick tour by taking advantage of a wonderful movie, which was put together by a friend of mine. Unfortunately, we're getting chopped off at the bottom. This is a movie by Brent Tully, and also, I just recently learned, by Joel Primack from UC Santa Cruz. So we're going to fly through the galaxy, fly out of the galaxy, and see neighboring galaxies. And as a result of looking at this movie, you will have a much better sense of how things are arranged in our local bit of space. So the movie starts by flying towards Orion. Here's the belt. Here's the Great Nebula, the shoulders, the knee, and so on. So let's start flying by aid of this movie. Okay? So now the first thing you notice is that Orion is disappearing. These constellations are not real groupings of stars. They're just chance alignments along the line of sight. And the first thing that's really coming towards us is this cloud of glowing gas. That's where stars form. This happens to be the Orion Nebula. I'll be saying a little bit more about it later in my talk. And as we fly past that a little bit farther away, there's another big cloud of gas. This is the Horsehead Nebula. Actually, that whole region of Orion is full of hydrogen and helium gas, which you can't even see in this picture because it doesn't emit any light. Now we're flying to another region of the Milky Way where stars are forming. This is the Rosette Nebula. And as we fly in, you'll see some bright stars at the middle, and their luminous light is exciting the cloud around them. So you sort of have a bunch of stars forming out of gas, and it illuminates where they came from because there's some leftover gas that's set to glow. This is another cloud, totally different. This is an exploding supernova remnant called the Crab Nebula. This is a dead and dying star, not a star that's actually forming. But now you see this distribution of sea of stars, 100 million of them all together in the Milky Way. We're flying out of the Milky Way, looking at the center from here to here, remember, is about 20,000 light years. And this is one of the great things about this movie. They've morphed this into another nearby local galaxy. So this is M83, NGC 5838. So that's a real galaxy. These are the Magellanic Clouds. Our view is swinging over to see the rest of the local group. This is the Andromeda Galaxy. This is a smaller one. Keep track of this little thing here. It's going to come back later in my talk. It's a glowing cloud of forming stars in this smaller galaxy. Andromeda has some satellite galaxies around it. And now our view is panning out away from the local group. And this is why Tully was the right guy to make this movie. Each one of these objects is a real galaxy that's been cataloged. It's its real picture that you are looking at. This is some famous ones familiar to amateur astronomers. This is the Whirlpool Nebula where spiral structure was discovered. And you will have noted by now that the galaxies are not uniformly distributed in space. By the way, you might ask, what would it look if I actually went out there and looked? Things would be distributed exactly like this. The sizes are completely realistic, except everything has been brightened up so that you could see it. The actual surface brightnesses of these objects are pretty low to be seen by the human eye. You need telescopes to brighten them up like this. And now we're flying to the center of the Virgo cluster, which is about 1,000 galaxies, the nearest big cluster. This is a huge elliptical galaxy with a giant black hole at the center called M87, and a very, very interesting kind of object. It's a good thing that the movie stops because we won't want to fly into the black hole. Okay, this movie, I think, is a masterpiece. Actually, you can see another version of it if you go to the Morrison Planetarium. It's become part of their planetarium show. So now, hopefully, you sort of have a mental image of what I'm talking about. Now, the remarkable thing, this is the astronomy part of my talk, the remarkable thing is we understand 95% of what you just saw. We understand where that stuff came from. So let me take 2 seconds to set the stage. Here is a galaxy. You have seen the pictures. Matter is not uniformly distributed in the cosmos today. It's in these lumps called galaxies. Why did the universe get lumpy? It's believed, and in fact we can observe, that the universe originally was very smooth. Now it's lumpy. Why? The answer is gravity. In the early universe, there were incredibly tiny little density ripples, only a part in 100,000. And yet, one of those little ripples had a bit stronger gravitational field around it and sucked matter in, combating the expansion of the universe. Where that won against the expansion, that's where we're left with the galaxy today. So, as I say, we understand all of that. We understand, believe it or not, the initial conditions of the ripples. We can put them into a computer simulation, and we can make a computer model of this clustering process. And that's my next slide. Okay? All right, so we started out with a sphere. It wasn't quite uniform. It had little ripples in it. As it expanded, one of the lumps created a density and homogeneity around it. And what I'm going to ask you to do next is, say, follow one of your favorite ones, like that one. Just watch what it does as we... Okay, so now you can see it's merging with others. It's a hierarchical clustering process in which we first form small lumps, and then those lumps merge together to make bigger ones. And as you can see, we could probably get a totally different result if we put in different initial conditions. So I'm hoping in the question period somebody will ask me about the initial conditions and why we think we understand them. Okay? I don't want to talk about that now. It would take too much time. Now this, as it happens, is an old simulation. And by the way, this was not the center of the universe. We could have watched a simulation over here, which would have looked essentially the same, and one over here, and one over here, right? All we did in this picture was look at a typical behavior of a typical region, and we focused our attention on the middle of that region. But the whole universe, all around this one, is expanding and behaving the same way. Now, here is a modern simulation. This was made by my colleague, Piero Madau at UC Santa Cruz. And this happens to be of interest because he picked a region of space that he set up to look like the Milky Way. So this is what our Milky Way looked like when it was forming. And our focus is now centered on the middle of the Milky Way, and we're going to see the universe expand. Okay? And now, with the miracle of modern computers, look at all of these lumps that we can now see. There are 3 billion particles in this simulation, and that's what gives us this really high resolution and high level of detail. So this is the center of the galaxy. To scale, the sun would be about here. This is about 20,000 light years. And this is material that is forming and clustering and coagulating in the environs of the Milky Way. Okay, now, those of you who know something about astronomy are thinking, what the heck? The Milky Way doesn't look like this. And it didn't look like that in the movie. When we looked at the pictures of the galaxies, we just saw a galaxy, right? We didn't see something that was surrounded by 10,000 other satellites the way you see here. Okay, so now I have to tell you something important. The important thing is that what you're seeing so far in these simulations is dark matter. Dark matter is, it's about 85% of all the matter in the universe. It's invisible. It's here right now. There are maybe 20 dark matter particles right here in this little volume, and that one, and that one, and that one. Each one is in orbit about the center of the galaxy with a speed of a couple hundred kilometers a second. The thing about dark matter is that it's non-interacting. It's like neutrinos, if you've heard of neutrinos. So it can just go through matter, and we don't notice it. And that's why, for many, many years, we didn't even know it was there. But astronomers discovered it from the gravity of dark matter and inferred that it must be present. So, unfortunately, with a telescope, we cannot make a picture like this. And it seems, although we don't totally understand, this is one of the 5% of cosmology that we don't quite get yet, we don't quite understand why that thing and guys like it are not visible today. So let me come back to that in a moment. Evidently, there's some efficiency issue. A big lump can be visible in a telescope, but these little ones are not. In a minute, you'll understand more about that. Let's go to the next simulation. The next simulation is the inverse of what we've just looked at. We just saw a dark matter simulation of the Milky Way. Now what we're going to do is look at a simulation that looks at the ordinary matter. The ordinary matter is this stuff. It's the matter of the periodic table. It's atoms, it's electrons, it's neutrons, it's protons, etc. It's what we know and study in chemistry, and it's what we're made out of. So it turns out that in the early universe, the dark matter and the ordinary matter were well mixed, and in the process of galaxy formation, they have separated. And that's because their physics are different. The main thing that we need to be aware of tonight is that ordinary matter is capable of making stars, and stars can shine, and that's what we see in our telescopes. The dark matter, as far as a telescope is concerned, is inert, but it's the gravity of the dark matter that's causing the galaxy to form. So in this simulation, which comes from Japan, all we're seeing now is the ordinary matter, and most of it is gaseous. When it looks smooth here, those are gas clouds, hydrogen and helium coming out of the Big Bang. And the dark matter has this sort of ropey clustering process. Properties, and it's drawing the gaseous matter together. The gaseous matter is coagulating in galaxies. Doesn't that look like a great spiral galaxy there? Right? And it's a hierarchical clustering process. We made two galaxies, and they're now going to merge and make a bigger galaxy. And so I think this, you know, a couple of simulations in my talk, I think, are just masterpieces of movie making, and this is one of them. At this point, we're about halfway through the age of the universe. And the moral is that early aspects of the Milky Way formation process were very chaotic when it was still in pieces and the pieces were merging together to make a bigger object. And slowly as time goes on, gas is turning into stars. So as time goes on, there are more stars and less gas. The stars are these little pinpricks that you can see through here. And every time there's a merger, the pre-existing stars, they might have been in a disk, but they're disturbed and they're thrown into a gigantic halo. And any leftover gas is settling down to a disk. Again, the physics of gas and stars are a little bit different, too. Gas always wants to settle to a disk. And that is, in fact, the properties, the structure of galaxies as we see them today. This is our Milky Way. This is the bright center of the Milky Way. This is the disk. And we can, with our telescopes, detect this far-flung halo of stars. So I'm trying to convince you that we've got the basic picture. Okay. So far, this is theory. It's been simulations. I don't have time tonight to convince you that there's tons of evidence in favor of this picture. I'll just say a little bit on that score. One of our major tools here is the Hubble Space Telescope, which gives wonderfully sharp pictures. Here is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, the deepest photo that people have ever taken of the cosmos. It took about 2 weeks of Hubble exposure time, and it cost about $20 million. So I don't know the cost of photos that the military has taken, but I can tell you that that's the most expensive photo ever taken by astronomers. Now, because of Hubble's resolution, this is the whole ultra-deep field blown up. Because of the resolution, really, there's a lot of detail that's visible here. Let me enlarge a piece of it, okay? And you can see that there are large galaxies and that there are small galaxies. And in general, the large ones are in the foreground, and the little ones look small because they're farther away. Now, there are ways of estimating the distance of every one of these things in here. And in fact, I'm head of a team that's busy doing that. And so the people who made the next movie took the Hubble Deep Field and made a movie. They estimated the distance of every object, arranged it along the line of sight, and the movie flies down. It's like a core drilling through space and also a core drilling through time, right? So as we do this, we're going, you know, like a billion years every 10 seconds. We're going back in time. We're taking advantage of the look-back effect in a big telescope because it takes a finite time for light to travel. So these big ones are in the foreground. And what I want you to see is that as we go farther out, the character of the galaxies is changing. First and foremost, they're getting smaller. And this is what we predict because of hierarchical clustering. We had small globs in the past, right? And you could just imagine, I don't have to tell you the details, that if a bunch of astronomers cataloged the properties of galaxies as a function of distance away from us, that would be tantamount to cataloging the properties of galaxies back in time. And effectively, we could assemble, with the help of some theory, a movie of galaxy formation using a telescope like Hubble. And that's what we're busy doing. Okay, so now I assume you believe we've made galaxies. That took maybe the first billion or 2 billion years in cosmic history, in our Milky Way's history, to get really going with galaxy formation. So now, the next thing we have to do, remember I'm talking about our cosmic history, the next chapter is we have to make some stars. And that's why we need galaxies. Without galaxies, the universe would have expanded and become so dilute that nothing interesting would happen. We need to get some stuff together in gas clumps so that it can actually form again under gravity to make stars. So star formation is the next chapter here. And remember this galaxy? We flew through it. We actually went right through that region where stars are forming. Here's the Hubble picture. Here's the cloud of very young stars. Young is like 1 or 2 million years, very young in cosmic terms. And their ultraviolet light has gone out. The photons have excited all of this gas surrounding gas and caused it to glow. So whenever we see regions that look like this, we say, aha, that must be a stellar nursery. Some of the most beautiful pictures taken by Hubble in our galaxy are of these regions. Here's a very young cluster, 2 million years old, and here is a region of gas that is excited by the ultraviolet light of those stars. This is my favorite all-time Hubble picture. Here are the young stars. Here are the gas out of which they've formed. It actually goes all the way around here. I love this. Here's a little star which photon pressure. The photons go out and actually excavate the cavity from which they've formed. It's like Bryce Canyon, okay? This is another Bryce Canyon artifact. Light is coming down and sculpting this region here. This pillar is protected by a dense blob of gas, kind of like, a harder stone at the top of the Bryce Canyon column. These are very active regions with intense radiation fields. So now let's look at the nearest interesting one, back to Orion. Remember the Orion Nebula? I pointed that out in the movie. Let's home in on that. This is the Hubble montage of Orion. Let's blow it up even more. Okay, focus on that region, enlarge even more. And when we do that, Hubble's resolution is just adequate to show us that some of the stars, stars are normally points of light even with Hubble. We don't resolve the disks of stars. But here in Orion, we can see that there's some structure. They're not exactly points of light. There are 57 of these things in Orion that have been cataloged. They're called protoplanetary disks. Here's an example of early ones. These are youngish. These are solar systems forming, and we think that something like this will evolve into this. So this is a star, and this is leftover gas and dust from which that star formed, settles into the rotating disk. The rotating disk is a big theme in astronomy. Saturn's rings, the ecliptic plane, protostellar nuclei, spiral rotating galaxies. Gas always wants to settle and make rotating disks. Okay, and we were even lucky, if you weren't convinced they were disks, one of these things is seen practically edge-on in Orion, and you can just see the central star peeping out over the edge. And the scale is pretty big, 17 times the diameter of Pluto's orbit, but that's about the size of the comet cloud that brings comets into our own solar system. So it sort of fits. Okay, now this simulation is another very good one. This one is fanciful in the sense that it's not actually a computer simulation. It's an artist concept. But still it's very good. It comes from the American Museum of Natural History. What we're doing is we're flying into Orion here, and we're going to fly around inside it. And these are the bright stars that are, their energy is determining what's happening in here. And you can see that there are these globs of gas like this. Photons are coming out and sweeping, evaporating and sweeping the gas off, creating these sort of cometary-like structures. And you can see there's lots of leftover gas, which is still in the process of making stars. Here's one of these cometary-like things. And in a minute, we're going to fly past this thing, which is a comet plus a little solar system disk, right? So you can see, my word that I use for star formation is fratricide. The question is, will you get to form your star before you're evaporated by your big brother? It's a chancy thing, you know. You might not make it. Okay. So let's now, again, look at another artist concept. Let's zoom down into what one of those early youngish disks might look like. And now I want you to remember the dust that we saw between the stars. It's the dust that is creating this silhouette, is creating the light-absorbing properties in these protostellar nebula, protosolar nebulae. And the dust particles actually coagulate with one another. They're sticky. Also, gravity helps. And so the little diffuse dust substrate begins to coagulate and make asteroids and rocks. This is, you know, if you went out and picked up some rock on the surface of the Earth, you are holding interstellar dust that coagulated in the interstellar, in the solar nebula, first in small bodies and later in larger bodies. How does that process look like? It's a little mysterious, another one of the 2% or so that we don't quite understand. Here is gravity doing its thing in a computer simulation. Started out with a smooth disk, and now you can see these particles forming, right? Those are the early planets that are forming mostly under the influence of gravity. Okay, so are the planets there? Every once in a while, I'm going to show you some evidence, right? So now, here's another piece of evidence. We now know, I think it's more than 500 planets. If I keep up, every week there are more. And they've been discovered using a Doppler technique, which when a big planet goes around a star, it causes its parent star to wobble, comes towards us, away from us, and we can actually measure that using the so-called Doppler shift. Now, the amazing thing is that we found a lot of planetary systems, but they are not like ours. The very first ones had Jupiter-sized planets practically grazing the surface of their parent stars. In our solar system, Jupiter is way out there at 5 times the radius of the Earth. So we now know that actually a lot of solar systems, if not most, are very different from our own solar system. Let me show you some more data on that. A good way of plotting solar systems is this way. Here's a graph. This is the distance of the planet from the star in units of the Earth's distance. And this is the mass of the planet in units of the Earth's mass. So the Earth is at 1:1 here. Okay, so now let's plot some other planets. These are the planets in our solar system, Jupiter, Venus, Mercury, etc., populating this part of the diagram. This is where all the planets were discovered, the first ones that came from this Doppler technique, which tends to pick planets that are close to their star and very heavy. So massive planets rather close in. It's important to know whether there are other kinds of planets, and now Kepler has gone up. Kepler is a new spacecraft that can see planets passing in front of stars called transits, and it's going to explore this region of the diagram. And there's another method called gravitational lensing, which potentially can explore that region of the diagram. When we've had a chance to digest all of these, then we will have begun to understand whether our galaxy is truly unique or not, or whether or not it's normal. More on that in a second. Okay? We've made stars, we've made planets. But we needed rocks in order to get planets to coagulate. Where do the rocks come from? They are the heavy elements. Hydrogen and helium come out of the Big Bang. But we need oxygen, carbon, magnesium, iron. Those are all cooked in stars. Here's a diagram that shows stars. These are massive stars. Massive stars synthesize these elements in their cores from hydrogen and helium, and then they, very fortunately, they explode. And when they explode, their heavy elements come out into space and seed the interstellar medium. Here's my rendition of a supernova, right? That was the supernova exploding, and here's the remnant that appears hundreds and thousands of years later. And this material is enriched with the iron, oxygen, carbon, etc., that was cooked inside the stars. Goes out, mixes with the gas, and is there available to make the next generation of stars. So we have a gigantic cosmic recycling machine here, or maybe a better name for it would be the cosmic soup, which with every circuit around these pictures, the cycle, is actually getting more and more heavy element rich. And there is some evidence to suggest that you can't make planets until your star and protosolar nebula has reached a certain level of this heavy element richness. Okay, so I'm almost finished with my cosmic timeline. Here's the Big Bang, 14 billion years ago. The first galactic stars in the Milky Way formed about 500 million years after that. Things sat around for a while, getting more and more metal rich, heavy element rich. Until that happened, we couldn't make planets. The disk of the galaxy is settling. And finally, the composition gets up to the point, thanks to the supernova, that we can start making planets in abundance, and we made the solar system. And that happened about 5 billion years ago. Okay? So now, at this point, the astronomer passes laterals to the geologist and the biologist. I think that there are about 10 chapters in the Book of Life, the Book of Humanity. The first three belong to astronomers, and the next ones belong to the geologists and the biologists, and so you'll have to have another talk on that. Okay. I'd like to go on, though, and talk about what are the implications that I see from this story for us today. There are some lessons. We got here according to laws of nature. We're not here by virtue of a miracle. Maybe the Big Bang was a miracle. I won't take a stand on that. Okay. After the Big Bang, no miracles are required. And furthermore, we are subject to the laws of physics and must live within them. That's very important when we think about our future. We got here about as fast as possible. In that story I just told you, the cosmic story, you could sit down and think about how quickly you could do each one of those steps. And we are very rare and lucky, or life is very easy when the conditions are right. Even so, it took 14 billion years to get here. I like to say that the universe has invested 14 billion years in us. The solar system may actually be exceedingly rare. I wish I had a whole lecture to tell you about that. There was a brilliant undergraduate senior thesis recently written at Santa Cruz showing that the solar system is stable. This is a mathematical question that goes back 200 years to Laplace. What do I mean by that? You can't assume anything with solar systems. One planet tugs on another, and as a result, when you have a heavy planet like Jupiter, it can send planets flying out into outer space. In fact, it turns out that our solar system on a time scale of something like 5 billion years has a 20% chance of being unstable. And this will happen because Venus will excite the orbit of Mercury. Mercury's orbit will get more and more eccentric, will become elongated, will start crossing Venus and Earth. That will allow Venus to start talking to Earth gravitationally. And the net result, man, we are history at that point. Okay, we are flung out into interstellar space, and we lose our star, and that would just happen in a couple of years, you know. So that would be terrifying. But that's 5 billion years. By that time, the sun itself will be on the way to being history. So on the time scale of a billion years, no problem. The sun itself has a billion years of useful life left. We are very lucky. We got here fast. We've been given the gift of cosmic time, another piece of luck. There are other cosmic dangers. We could be hit by an asteroid, by a comet, or gradually over this billion years, the sun will warm up a little bit. Believe it or not, we could cosmically re-engineer the solar system. We could move Venus in, and we could move the Earth out with an appropriately positioned asteroid. Net result is we have to worry about these things, and we're searching for asteroid impacts right now, but probably manageable. Incredibly lucky. Our future, our cosmic future, is bright ahead. Okay, so now in what's left, let me zoom through my final points. I want to change the orientation to talk about us today and where we're going and why what I think I told you is important. We're all thinking about the estimates of world population. That is generally taken to be a serious limiting factor in the viability of human life on Earth. This is a chart of population. This is where we are now. These are future estimates. I've been reading about how many people the Earth can support. Most people's viewpoint is how many people can the Earth feed. Using those estimates, the safe range is right in here. All right? So actually, this looks rather encouraging, because so many of these curves, this is the high scenario, this is the low scenario, looks from the standpoint of food that we might be in good shape. I'm going to argue that that's not the case. It's good to look at human population in this graph, which takes a longer time horizon. And then you see this almost flat-looking plateau and the sudden shooting up at the present time. Why did that happen? This is an interesting way of replotting. For those of you who don't know logarithms, you should go out and learn about them. Okay. This is time, just as it was before, but now this coordinate is not the linear number, it's the logarithm of the number. And a plot like this, if you see a straight line in it, tells you that that process, whatever it is growing a certain percent per year. In particular, I put a line through here, that's 0.07% growth per year of this thing, whatever it is. Okay, so what's plotted here is the history of world population logarithmically. Here, it seems to break into three clear divisions. Flat, this curve, which is linear, and that curve, which suddenly shoots up. So it sort of screams out at you and it says, why do I have two breakpoints? And it turns out that two important things happened right at these times. The horse was domesticated and coal was put to use, and that's what triggered the Industrial Revolution. So really, and many people are saying this, I'm not making this up, the main driver of human population is not the availability of food, it's the availability of energy, which you then use to produce food. So further evidence, here is the real income per person, that's the standard of living in England during this period of time, the medieval time to now. Flat, not doing anything, and then suddenly shooting up right here. This is the Industrial Revolution. What happened? We got new forms of power, in particular coal. Most of the U.S. increase in GDP over the last decades has been driven by an increase in the amount of use of energy. For many years, it went exactly parallel. In recent years, we're more aware of energy. We're starting to conserve. And so the GDP has continued to rise when energy usage has started to level off. That's promising, but it's a recent trend. And finally, take a look at this. Another log-log plot. Okay. This correlates gross domestic product per capita of countries versus energy consumption per capita. And again, a beautiful trend. The only outliers are countries like this that produce a lot of oil. Okay, so what I didn't realize this. When I sat down to give this talk, I thought about food. I didn't think about energy. I'm now a believer in energy. And these are predictions about world energy production in the future. Here we are now. For those of you who can't see, this is the present. And it's predicted that we're soon going to reach a maximum. And unless we do something, energy sources are going to go down. This is bad because even if the population levels off, as you know, there are rising middle classes who want a higher standard of living. There's going to be a lot of instability in the world if we don't find more energy sources. I'm going to annoy some of you by saying that nuclear energy is something that we should think more about. I have a friend who tells me that there's totally different and much safer ways of doing nuclear energy, and you should have him come and talk at the Commonwealth Club. Okay, that, all of it, though, is old think, I think. This is how people thought 10, 15 years ago. They thought in terms of inputs, inputting food, inputting energy. That's not how we should think. We should think of outputs, in particular waste. And so if you read, as I did, discussions of how many people the Earth can support from 20, 15 years ago, you will never even see any mention of this. You will never see any mention of climate change. This is a plot of CO2 levels, and you see what they're doing recently in the last 100 years or so. And, of course, this time right here, this is 1800. This is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Isn't it? It's amazing how this plot looks like the standard of living plot from England. Same plot. So, little sideways remark here. The astronomer has to remind you how fragile the Earth's atmosphere is. The atmosphere is thin. 10 miles that way, I think it's that way, is Oakland. 10 miles that way is outer space. Literally, right? Never take the atmosphere for granted, and screwing it up with CO2 is a bad idea. I also like this plot, which I got from my colleague Joel Premack. This is a replot of the carbon dioxide plot, but now it's put zero on it, okay? And it shows you what came from human levels. And to argue that somehow CO2 is not going up because of human production, people have not seen this plot. Okay, so now what is sustainable growth on a cosmic timescale? Let's say we're going to do it for 1 billion years, because that's what the sun is giving us. Let's assume no more than a factor of 2 growth over 1 billion years. What is that, the growth per year? That's what it is, okay? So we're used to seeing growth of 3% per year. That's what we want. We feel as though we've failed. The economy has failed. That's impossible. The astronomer in me screams whenever I look at what the stock market is doing or what GDPs are doing. It is hopeless. We simply have to get out of that mode. So effectively, there can be no increases in resources or population, and waste, as it's produced, must be reduced to levels that can be naturally recycled. Okay, now, there's a guy who took my title by writing a book a few years ago. Timothy Ferris is one of my heroes. Coming of Age in the Milky Way. This is a special moment for 2 reasons. First of all, it's the first moment in our history that we could know our cosmic history and predict our cosmic future. It's also the first moment in our history when we're really bumping up against the limits of our own planet. So this is a special moment in 2 ways, and this is exactly what happens to you when you come of age. You have a much better sense of where you came from and where you're going, and you have a sense of limits and what you have to live within. So this title, even though he didn't quite write it this way, I think exactly describes our current situation. Okay, so now let's try to imagine our future. Is there any way out of this? What will life look like? Okay? Maybe we'll look like Watson. Don't laugh, because actually, before I started this talk, I thought that was the answer. Because I thought that a machine could last a long time. And I thought that perhaps it would need less maintenance. Obviously, I don't think our descendants are exactly going to look like Watson. This is what Watson looks like. He has a hard time getting around. But nevertheless, I assume that that could be fixed. There's a much bigger problem with Watson. The problem with Watson is that she uses a million more watts per flop. A flop is a floating point operation. It's a measure of computer speed. The energy that this computer uses is 1 million times more than the human brain. It uses, what did I calculate? It uses 10,000 times more energy than your brain, and it's 100 times slower than your brain. Right? And you put those 2 things, there's just no way. Okay. So, I learned stuff in the process of putting this talk together. So, I don't think it's Watson. Is it Bhutan? Okay, the agrarian Shangri-La. Andy and I went to Bhutan, made me really think about whether Bhutan should be our future. Here are some beautiful pictures of Bhutan. It really does look like this. And it's famous for inventing this slogan, gross national happiness. I'm sure you've all heard of this. I think this is falling apart. As part of my research for this talk, I read up on recent events in Bhutan. Bhutan is going down the tubes. It's got gang problems. It's got an urbanization problem. In essence, it has a westernization problem. And the fact is, I don't know how Andy felt when he went there. I felt that it would be boring to live. I thought that living in Bhutan was sort of like going to heaven, you know, where you sat on a cloud and you grew some vegetables and that's about all you thought of. So I would say that I personally have an addiction to something. And I think the human species does. And as soon as the Bhutanese were now allowed to indulge in this addiction, all of this beautifully structured society that they have constructed, I think, is in the process of falling apart. So what are the irreducible requirements for a long-term human society or human-like society? I reject this question. I think that's not a good way of phrasing it. I think a better way is, what kind of society would you like to live in? And I submit that you want the basics: food, water, health, education. This is very important. You want the opportunity for personal growth and change. That's what I think the Bhutanese somewhat lack. And this is very important, and I think this is the sticking point. Newness in the form of new art, knowledge, technology, products, social experiments, and new challenges that have been met and surmounted. And if you give any human being the chance to live in Bhutan versus a place like this, he will, or she, I think, will choose that place. So that's what we should be aiming for. Back to the future, a sustainable society based on the mechanisms of biology. I rejected Watson. I'm using brains or something like brains. Since stimulation and novelty are now valued, I say that the number of people, I'm not sure they're really people, but call them people, I mean, it's a billion years from now, should be maximized, because that's what makes for interesting situation. This is not what John Stuart Mill said. He said that we should all have, you know, we should have about three people on Earth, and they should all sit under trees and think. I don't think that's what people are about. So the goal is to reduce the environmental impact to 1% of the current level. Why did I pick 1%? I don't know. It just seems safe. I think 100% is very, very dangerous. And as you can see, in a minute, going lower, there's going to be a penalty if you go lower than 1%. So let's take 1%, and we're going to try to maintain an adequate standard of living, and we're going to do that using an energy index, because energy, as I've argued, sets standard of living. So currently, California is a factor of two better than the U.S., and California, together with Europe, are the same. I'm going to assume, I think conservatively, a factor of two gain in energy efficiency. And I'm going to scale now these numbers and try to figure out what the world population would look like if it's using that much energy, and I'm assuming that environmental impact is in proportion to energy usage. Net result, I've got a world with 50 million people in it. And that's why I say back to the future, because that's the start of the Iron Age at 1000 BC. Still, 50 million, that's not too bad. Better than I expected. I couldn't be content without estimating the number of astronomers. Okay? Currently, there are about 5,000 astronomers. There would be 400 astronomers proportionally in this world. I'm not really claiming that we'd have any astronomers. Astronomers might be dead at that point, and, you know, not an interesting subject, but you get the idea. Astronomers live at the top of a technological pyramid. Okay, so here's my last slide. A 1 billion year voyage of spaceship Earth, what does it take? First of all, I think it takes some modest adjustments to human nature through bioengineering. I'm in favor and I support genetic engineering. I think it's hard to see exactly how we'll do this, but I think it does hold out the promise of getting our way out of some of the, we're prisoners of our genome if we really want to last on Earth for a whole billion years. So we could be tuning our fertility, our lifespan, our intelligence, our creativity. We might be reducing this horrible addiction to growth. We might be increasing a concern for others, and we might be increasing a concern for future generations. Along with that will go an adoption of some new cultural standards and goals. It's pretty obvious what they would be. There will have to be a more tightly regulated society. Sorry, Republicans. There will be more rules and regulations. You'll have to behave if you want to live on spaceship Earth. That will involve population control. Those of us who are outraged by the one-child policy in China are not thinking like astronomers. And finally, there has to be a new form of government. And I think, I didn't plan it this way, but wouldn't you agree that events in Washington today absolutely show that democracy is not for us? Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Sandy. We have some time for questions. So if you have a question, please raise your hand, and I will pass the mic to you, and Sandy will answer.
How are you able to sleep at night knowing all this?
My lifespan is only another 20 years or so.
But I'm serious about that question. If you have all this information and you know what's going on, you're in a dilemma. You're living in a dilemma.
What is the dilemma? The dilemma is that I am an energy consumer, just like everybody else.
I understand that, but you know a lot more than most other people know about the evolutionary process of the universe. In that, you have to experience some frustration about how we are living our lives and the westernization of Bhutan, because the whole planet wants to become America, which is a dysfunctional culture. How do you live with that? People think we're the greatest. We're not.
Well, you've read more into my talk than I wanted you to do. Okay, I don't think America is so bad. I just think we should be a lot smaller. I actually think that I'd much rather live in America than the old Bhutan. I think you'd be bored out of your skull in the old Bhutan.
All right, another question?
Maybe we should continue later.
Okay.
Could you say something about the Big Bang Theory, how that started? And also, you made a quick mention of that the planets in our solar system might come together and destroy Earth. So what do you think could be done about that?
Okay. Right. Those are two questions. Maybe I could take them one at a time. The Big Bang Theory is motivated by the fact that we see that the universe is expanding. And we have detected something in the universe that could be present only if it had a hot, dense phase. It's called the cosmic microwave background radiation. So for a long time, we knew that there was a Big Bang, and it was hot, and the universe is expanding and gradually cooling. We still don't know where the Big Bang came from. I think that's the huge element in my story that is the big unknown. Many astronomers, myself included, now think that there are other universes and that there's some machine out there outside of our universe that is just grinding out universes, just the way our galaxy grinds out planets of every kind and description. And our universe has the properties the way it is just because we need to be in it, or we are in it, in the same way that we couldn't be on Jupiter. So, you know, Earth cannot look like Jupiter because we could not survive on Jupiter. So I don't know that I can say anything more helpful to you about the Big Bang. It's a big mystery. Moving on to the instability of the solar system. I didn't mean to say that the planets would converge on Earth and somehow pulverize it or vaporize it. Rather that every planet has its own mass. Not all the mass is in the sun. That means that every planet is a source of gravity and they all pull on each other. And Jupiter is the big boy. He's doing most of the pulling. And so we can get into something called a resonance. It's sort of like pushing a swing or something like that, you know. If they get into a certain configuration, then every time Mercury goes around in its orbit, it will be pulled by Venus. And that will accentuate any sort of non-circularity in Mercury's orbit. And it can get more and more eccentric, and pretty soon you see that Mercury is orbiting and it's coming close to Venus, and it's coming out in the vicinity of the Earth. And once you've done that, it's a highly unstable situation. And the interesting thing is that most of the solar systems that have been discovered thus far are like that. Very interesting. They're full of eccentric orbits. So making a solar system with circular orbits is a very tricky, delicate thing, and I think we don't fully understand how that happened to us.
If they should come too close, we don't have the technology to keep them apart.
We don't have the technology to do it quickly. We can move planets around, but we need probably millions of years to think about it.
So how would you refactor your model if we actually did have limitless power? Because I'm sure you noticed that we have this big yellow object in the sky, our sun, which all life on Earth, you know, owes its very existence to the sun. So in the future, I think it's a pretty obvious assumption that our future relies on that
right.
star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people have calculated the population of the Earth, assuming that we could capture and utilize all the solar photons. And interestingly enough, it only increases the estimates by about a factor of 10. So there isn't that much solar power actually falling on the Earth. And, of course, it's incredibly hard to capture because it's so diffuse. So you could get more solar power by putting some sort of sphere around the sun, you know, a sphere the size of the Earth's orbit, and plastic, papering it all over with solar cells. That would do a lot.
Looking at the new National Geographic magazine, I don't know if you've seen it or not, but it's so much pertains to the last third of your talk. We can make a fox, a wild fox, domesticated to the equivalent of a collie dog in 9 generations.
Isn't it amazing? I read that too.
And a lot of the geological age they're factoring, beginning with the carbon and so forth. Just a whole lot of it. And this is in the March issue of National Geographic, for your awareness.
Yeah, thank you. I've got to run out and get it.
So among the many exponential curves that we've seen in the last, several decades, how about the telescopes, and what has that done for your life?
I calculated once that my per capita photon capture rate as an astronomer is now 1 million times bigger than when I was a graduate student. Yeah. So, and it's been a combination of factors, bigger telescopes, more sensitive detectors, and building instruments that look at multiple objects in a telescope at one time. So I would say that the story I've told you, we would not know without that factor of 1 million.
Sandy, you highlighted in yellow that Earth may be extremely rare, and a lot of people are saying, I guess, agreeing with that, but at the same time, the numbers are so enormous out there that extremely rare could still mean that there's billions of Earths. I mean, where are you on that? You mean so rare that we're the only ones?
You know, there are a bunch of factors that people like to cite. I'm not an expert on this. As being really crucial to the success of life as we know it on Earth. Very important to say, as we know it. Maybe some other kind of life could have done with other conditions, right? So we need a sun. We need a stable solar system. We need an Earth-like planet at the right distance. We need a magnetic field to protect our atmosphere. That's one of the reasons why Mars doesn't have an atmosphere, because it's ablated by the solar wind. Some people have argued that we need the moon. I don't really understand that argument very much. But by the time you know, it's a percent times a percent times a percent. If I did that, that would be 10 to the minus 10 right there. Okay? That's the number, just about the number of stars in the galaxy. In fact, it's smaller than the number of stars in the galaxy. So by the time you put together multiple iffy-ish factors, you can get a number that's pretty small. So where am I on this? I'm come see, come saw kind of thing.
All right. So we have time for one more question, and then you can all talk with Sandy afterwards.
Sandy, what do you think that created organic life?
My first instinct is to take refuge in the fact that I'm an astronomer, not a biologist. I think what you're looking for is a very general kind of answer, and that's good because that's all I can come up with. I think it's natural processes. I think it is a bunch of early chemical reactions that occurred, and it probably evolved because it was under pressure of evolution, just like mature organisms are under the pressure of evolution. So successful, in some sense, reactions were promoted and unsuccessful ones weren't. I'm not willing at the moment to resort to a miracle.
All right. Please join me in thanking Sandra Faber. Well, I'd like to thank you, our audience, and the audience listening at home. This concludes the meeting for this evening for the Commonwealth Club of California in its 108th year.